Up next in this hour of Downtown, happy to welcome to the show one of the great voices in rock and roll music. He's been making great music for more than four decades on his own as a member of terrific bands like Ace, Squeeze, Mike and the Mechanics, and more. Has toured with everybody in the business, been a great session player as well. We caught up with the wonderful Paul Carrick, who's got a new album out called One on One. We talked with him via Zoom earlier today. Well, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
No, pleasure.
Well, let's jump right into it here. The new album is so good, One on One, and I understand that not that it happened by accident, but you guys, like everybody else, came off the road when this all hit a couple of years ago, and then you ended up having more time than you expected.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. We were a couple of months into, you could call it a world tour, I think, because we were in the UK. We'd done about 30 shows, and mid-March, when everything closed down, we were supposed to come to Australia, Japan. I was going to be coming to the States with Eric Clapton playing in his band. And found myself with a bit of time on my hands. So fortunately, I do have a place here at home, a nice space with a rig. And although I didn't have any songs whatsoever, I had a blank sheet of paper, but I just gradually, without any pressure really, just fell into writing some new stuff. And because I'm a jack of all trades, I play a bit of everything, you know, and put together an album.
What's the process like? How different is it when you're doing it all yourself like that?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask, because it's quite difficult to describe, and I'm not sure myself, really. I mean,
well, I asked because I saw an interview, and you said that sometimes when you're working with others in a more collaborative effort, you can be easily persuaded.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
Did this give you a result that's more of a Paul Carrick album?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's not the first time I've recorded tracks by myself. I started to go off the idea because it takes such a long time, but time wasn't an issue in this case, and in fact it was quite therapeutic, I suppose you could say, to be occupied and have so much time to fiddle around. So I enjoy that process. I like working with other people too, for sure, but it's not that unusual. But as for the dynamic of how it actually happens, it's difficult to describe, because there's no formula. It happens in various ways. Usually I start off with some little idea. I may be free forming at the keyboard and just sing something stupid that I somehow then develop and make into a song.
Well, the first song you released as a single did very well, got a lot of airplay for you, a wonderful ballad, You're Not Alone. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I was a little surprised, actually, because I thought it was, a bog standard sort of ballad. But it did seem to strike a chord with quite a lot of people. Actually got on the mainstream radio over here in the UK, which they'd gone a little bit quiet on my previous album, which is a shame, because it's a good album. But there were some changes going on with their agendas down there. But anyway, we're not talking about that. We're talking about You're Not Alone. Yeah, again, the tune came very easily, but I wasn't sure what the song was going to be about. But in the back of my mind, I think there were some feelings of, because I had a couple of close people who were struggling a bit with the, the pandemic and the repercussions and other things going on. And I was actually listening to some sort of talk radio show one day, and I just heard somebody say, can't even remember what the subject was, but they were sort of saying, blah, 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 blah. And if you think the world's going crazy, you're not alone. And I thought, oh, wait a minute, that might work. And so that was handy to have a title.
Another terrific song from the album. I love I Miss You So. And then hearing the story behind it makes it even more powerful to me. That was certainly inspired by your daughter and a brand new granddaughter, I understand.
Yeah, that's right. That was in the January of 2020. And of course, you know, things were getting shut down. It was a very traumatic birth, as it happens. But don't worry, I don't go into detail in the song. But it was a difficult birth and a very anxious time for us all. Then there was the whole lockdown thing, so we weren't able to be as supportive as we would have liked to have been, you know. So, I mean, like all my songs, I try and keep them a bit ambiguous so, you know, the listener can interpret it in their own way. But that is what it's about.
Despite everything that was going on, this is a very positive, very upbeat album, and it gets off to a great start. Good and Ready. It is such a fun, make you want to get up and move your feet kind of song.
Cool. Yeah, well, I think part of that was the fact that we were on the road and it was going really well. And I think to some extent I carried that momentum into writing for this album, because I think initially I didn't imagine it was going to be, you know, best part of 2 years. I mean, we were just sort of rescheduling dates for in a couple of months' time. So I think I was still in, had a bit of momentum. And I think that's why I carried that sentiment into some of the writing.
Now, you did most of this yourself, but toward the end of the making of the album, things lightened up a little bit, and you were able to get some friends in for some great contributions. Robbie McIntosh, you've worked with many times before. Great guitar work. Pee Wee Ellis, Michelle John. Yeah. So many talents that added to it.
Well, fantastic. I mean, as I say, I'm a bit of a jack of all trades and I play a bit of everything, but I don't play the wind instruments. I had written some parts using, you know, samples and keyboards for the horn parts. But as the restrictions eased up a little bit in the UK, I was able to bring in some people. You mentioned Pee Wee Ellis there, and of course, Pee Wee sadly passed away fairly recently. So I think probably his last contribution was playing on my record. He did a great arrangement on a song called Lighten Up Your Mood. And so he was a wonderful character. I'm so glad I got to know him in the last 2 or 3 years. Quite a character, quite a legend, quite some stories. And that was great to get to know him. And we're all, you know, sad that he passed away.
I'm old school, so I like to listen to an album the way we used to, when you had liner notes and you would place the needle down and listen all the way through. And I love the sequencing of this album. Was that intentional?
Well, it can be important. I mean, these days, of course, people make their own playlists and what have you and compile stuff. But I think if an album does have a flow to it, I think it's good to listen. I'm like you. I'm old school, and I like it. I mean, there's no intentional thread, you know, preconceived thread, but at the same time, I think naturally it does have a bit of a story, you know, to tell.
And one of the great joys and surprises of me on the album was hearing a tremendous cover of the great Kenny Odell song that Charlie Rich had a big hit with here, Behind Closed Doors.
Yeah, I love it. I loved that record in the 70s. And it was just a song we'd often play at soundcheck. And it is my ambition one day to make a country record.
Oh, that would be great.
I love Charlie Rich's voice. I love the piano playing. The guy's name escapes me at the moment. He's played on a million country records.
And was that Pig Robbins?
Yeah, I believe it was, yeah. Because that's how I learned, was just by ear. I've never had a lesson in my life, you know. I just sort of listened to records and try to figure out how they did that. I always say I wish there'd been YouTube back in the day.
When I listened to that version, I thought, I was thinking of other Charlie Rich songs, and man, you would do a killer version of a song his wife wrote, Life's Little Ups and Downs.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that one, but I'm going to look it up. Who is his wife?
Margaret Ann Rich, Peggy Rich.
Oh, okay.
But she wrote that, and it was a minor hit, but a very bluesy kind of song, which I think is why it didn't score as well on the country charts back in the 60s.
Right. Well, the most beautiful girl in the world was a big hit here in the UK as well.
Oh, yeah. We're talking.
I'm going to see if I can plunder the Charlie Rich discography.
There you go. We're talking with Paul Carrick on Downtown. If we can go back a little bit, it's safe to say that you came from fairly modest beginnings in Sheffield.
Definitely. Yeah, but I mean, that was the vast majority of people. It was an industrial city. It had been, hammered in World War II. I mean, I was born in 1951, but, the place was still coming up. You know, it's a town in Yorkshire. People are quite known for being kind of fairly dour. And, we lived in fairly austere conditions. You could certainly say that. I mean, it was, we didn't have a heating or a bathroom. We had a tin tub that in front of the fire once a week, and outside toilet and all that. But so did everybody else. So as kids, we didn't feel particularly deprived. But when we could play outdoors all the time, in all kinds of weather, so it was a great, childhood actually.
You are such the epitome, I think, of a working musician and artist. How much of that work ethic came from seeing your parents?
Oh, absolutely. It's a curse, if anything. But no, they were very hardworking people. My mom's side, they were very poor, but, they worked hard. My dad had a little, likewise, but he had a little more flair, and he was a self-employed guy, whereas a lot of my uncles and that worked either in steel or engineering or coal. My dad was a painter and decorator. That's he paint people's houses, and he could turn his hand to anything actually, but they really did work hard, to make life better for us kids. And I'm sure a lot of that's rubbed off on me and on my kids even. They work hard, and they don't have any entitlement issues or anything like that.
We talked with Jimmy Webb about this, dealing with the loss of a parent. We talked with Graham Nash about it. I lost my mom when I was 12. You lost your dad when you were 11 years old. That's something that in many ways you never get over. And it affects the way you view the world, doesn't it?
I think it does. I mean, it was a long time ago. I mean, I'm older than my dad was, but, no, it had a profound effect on me as a kid. It made me a little bit insecure, a bit of a warrior. I was, and even to this day, I still kind of, when things are going well, I still expect a kick up the backside to happen. It was a devastating blow for the whole family, but I did have tremendous support we had as a family, and my mom and my brother. We had my mom's family and her sisters and my uncles and cousins were so supportive. It was absolutely, saved us.
Now, you had a good relationship with your dad, so it wasn't quite the story that's described in the living years, but you still wanted to record the lead vocal when Mike and the Mechanics put that together.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I don't know why, like you say, it was the subject matter. It's very different. I had a great relationship with my dad. I loved him to bits, as did everybody. He was a very popular guy. He was a lovely guy. And I only knew him for 11 years, so he must have had a, quite an effect. But what were we saying? I can't remember. I'm sorry.
Just that you really wanted to sing the lead vocal on The Living Years.
Yeah, I felt so. I felt it was kind of a tribute. I think it was more that the fact of losing somebody at that young age and experiencing that loss, I felt I was able to put it over, that sense of loss, at least, even though it didn't. Yeah.
Let's go back to the early years. How did you get from warm dust to forming Ace in the 1970s?
Well, it wasn't that massive a leap, but I mean, Warm Dust, I thought was safely locked away in the closet, but it does keep cropping up every now and again. We were a sort of a prog rock band. Our hero was Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. It was we had some wacky compositions. But sort of with the advent of the prog rock thing and things in London went reverse, you know, people started just playing in pubs and playing rock and roll for fun and being a little bit less pretentious. And two of the guys that had been in Warm Dust, they got together with these two guitar playing songwriters and formed Ace. And they said, be nice to have keys in the band. And they said, well, we know a guy. And that I was the last one in to join. Yeah.
And am I right that the only reason you ended up singing lead on How Long is because you wrote the song and that was the arrangement? If you wrote the song, you got to sing it?
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty much how it worked. I mean, I'd only really started writing songs. I mean, you mentioned the other band, they weren't real songs that we wrote. We wrote these epic 20-minute pieces. But I started to write songs, and we would do them in our set. And funnily enough, How Long was it's probably the first time I sang lead on a record, actually. But we were playing that in our set, and when we were eventually got ourselves a little record deal with a small label in the UK, and that was how that started.
And if I'm right, was it your bass player that was being courted by Sutherland Brothers and Quiver, and that's really what How Long was about?
Well, it is, yeah. I mean, we were a little band just having fun, but we were really tight. We were all soccer players. We loved, and we were just having great fun being together and everything. And then it was the Sutherland Brothers and Quiver, everybody knows now. So they were doing rather better than us. They had a record deal. They had the tours supporting people like Elton John and things like that. And they borrowed our bass player for a few shows. And during the course of that time, they were trying to get him to leave us and join them. And that's what it's about. But fortunately, he stayed with us.
Now, speaking of supporting people, How Long became such a massive worldwide hit, and you guys went out on tour, if I'm right, as the opening act for Yes.
Yeah, that was pretty much our initiation into touring in the US, which was quite a shock to the system because none of us had ever done anything like that before. I think we did 3 months with Yes, and they toured hard. I mean, they burned their way through a lot of truck drivers because they were playing almost every night in arenas. So this was all pretty new to us. And we were just this scruffy little bar band with, you know, a couple of spotlights on stage and playing our little set. And but fortunately, we just about got away with it because that song had become such a big radio hit in the States. It was undeniable, you know.
You did a couple of years with Roxy Music, and then in the early 80s, I got together with Chris Difford, Glenn Tilbrook, the guys in Squeeze after Jules Holland had departed. How did that all come about?
Well, it's a long story. Squeeze had been taken on by a manager called Jake Riviera. Jake Riviera, he founded Stiff Records in the UK, which was a kind of punk new wave label, and he had discovered Elvis Costello, and he was big friends with Nick Lowe and people like that. And he'd taken on Squeeze. Jules had left the band. They needed a keyboard player. They tried a lot of people. Nobody seemed to fit. And as a last resort, I think Jake said, well, what about Paul Carrack? He's back in town. He's been out there playing with Roxy Music, and you know, give him a shout. So that's what happened. And I went down to their rehearsal place, sat in, and they were about to start recording an album called East Side Story the following week. And they said, well, you want to do it? And I said, sure. I was absolutely blown away by their musicality, you know, and their songs are fantastic. So
we talked to Chris Difford a couple of years ago, and boy, for my money, he's one of the best lyricists of all time in rock music.
Well, I agree. I mean, he has his own inimitable style. Mm. And I got the honor of singing lead vocals on the song Tempted. And I still think that's a great, great song, a great pop song, and a great lyric. The kind of lyric I don't think I could write if my life depended on it. You know, it's just one of those great stories, you know, visual imagery and all that stuff.
But you've continued to write with Chris through the years, right?
Yeah. Normally on pretty much every album I've done, and I've done a few albums, solo albums on my own label in the last 20 years. I usually do write one or two with Chris, but we didn't quite get it together on this recent album. For one reason or another, you know. But I'm sure we'll do stuff in the future.
Mike and the Mechanics was such an all-star team of talent. What was it like to be part of that group of really terrific musicians?
It was great, actually. I mean, Mike, obviously, is the guitar player from Genesis, Mike Rutherford, and he had started to record what I think was going to be a solo album. While Genesis were kind of off the road and Phil Collins's career had just gone through the roof, and Mike started to make a solo album, but he didn't want to sing. And I can tell you the whole long story about how I got to be involved, but it would take a few minutes. But it was great period, you know, and a lot of fun. We had some success. We had some hit records, including a number one in the States, which I was singing. That's The Living Years. And so that was great. But I mean, I'm not involved with Mike and the Mechanics anymore. To be honest, there's just not enough time to do everything. And these days I'm kind of more concentrating on my solo stuff and the playing with Eric, which is great also.
I do have to ask you about one Mike and the Mechanics song that you wrote. I've got a sweet spot for whistling on record, and I love the whistling that you did on Over My Shoulder. And then I caught an interview where you said you're kind of a compulsive whistler.
Yeah, I am totally. In fact, I used to room with Chris Difford on tour with Squeeze. He actually bought me some bird seed one day because I was driving him insane. But no, my dad was a whistler, painter and decorator, you see. And but Over My Shoulder wasn't really a hit in the States.
Right.
It was huge in Europe. And I still do that song myself in my own set. But yeah, it didn't really catch on in the States, that one.
We're talking with Paul Carrick on Downtown. In the midst of the Mike and Mechanics success, you released a great solo album in the late 80s, One Good Reason, loaded with terrific songs, and one that became a smash, not only here, but everywhere. Don't Shed a Tear. That's just one of the great songs of the last 40 years.
Well, I don't know. It was my one and only top 10 hit in the States as a solo.
Which is a crime.
Well, it's what it is. It was very exciting time to have a solo record in the chart like that. It was, again, a big radio hit. I had a little bit of a difficult time because at that time, my wife got quite seriously ill. And I had to fly home from the States in a mid-tour. And she's fine now, by the way. She's good. And but I lost a little bit of momentum there, and the career went on a bit of a meander. But you know, still going strong.
So I love the story. We've had Don Felder on our show a couple of times. I love the story that you and Don and Timothy B. Schmidt were pretty close to forming your own group, like late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, we kind of did. I mean, this is around, I think it's about 1994, something like that. I got a call from Don out of the blue telling me he was interested. You know, they wanted to do something, but this is when the Eagles, before they reformed, sort of thing. And I knew Timothy Schmidt quite well. I mean, I met him in 75 on our first tour of America. He was in a band called Polco at the time. And whenever we were in LA, either with myself or with Nick Lowe or somebody like that, Timothy would come down to the show. Sometimes he'd bring Don Henley. And so I guess that was the connection. Anyway, Don Felder called me up about that. And yes, I went over to California. We were writing stuff and recording these songs with a view to forming a band. But to cut a long story short, I've already made it long, haven't I? But cut a long story short, the Eagles reformed. And obviously, so that was kind of the end of that project. But one of the songs that I'd taken over to the States was a song called Love Will Keep Us Alive. And that was a song that Timothy sang on the Eagles album on Hell Freezes Over when they got back together. So
yeah, and an award-winning song. It was the most played song, I think, of 1995.
It was certainly one of the most played songs. I've got some trophy on my sideboard somewhere at home where I think it was the most played PRS. That's the Performing Rights Society here in the UK. But I don't know. Anyway, they got a lot of airplay.
Well, and that Eagles connection paid off again in 07 when they did their comeback album, Long Road Out of Eden, and recorded another song of yours, I Don't Want to Hear Anymore.
That's right. I'd been in touch with Timothy, and he mentioned they were recording an album, and he was looking for a song. And he asked me if I had anything. I said, I don't, but I'll sure try and write something. So I put the phone down, and unusual for me, I just went straight into it and came up with the basic chorus for that song, I Don't Want to Hear Anymore. And over the course of the year, again, it's a long story, which I won't bore you with the details, but I was very, very honored that Timothy recorded that with the Eagles on Long Road Out of Eden. So that's two feathers in my cap, big time.
Now, you've done so much session work through the years with people like the Pretenders, Elton John. Yeah, you're playing on the biggest selling single in the history of the music business. But I read an interview where you said that you don't always feel comfortable in that role because you look around and see these other musicians. And you were a self-taught guy, but do you feel sometimes like you've got to work a little harder?
Yeah, well, I didn't. I'm a lot more secure about it now. But when I first started to do sessions, I saw it as a way of progressing as a musician. As you say, I'm self-taught. I'd only ever played in, two or three bands. And so my vocabulary, musical vocabulary wasn't that large, But I've always had good ears and good musical instincts. I didn't always have the technique to back it up. And I would often feel in those sessions that, it could go the wrong way and I could get found out, They'd found out I couldn't really play. But it very rarely happened, to be honest with you. And as I said, I've always looked upon that as being a learning thing, and things have happened. I never was one of those guys who were working sessions all the time. I just happened to get lucky and get on a few really good tracks.
And you've toured so much. You've been part of Ringo's all-star band, touring with Roger Waters, with Eric Clapton. Is that, not that it's not hard work, but is it a different feel just being a member of the band instead of out there headlining your own shows?
Yeah, it is quite different, actually. And it's good. They're both good for their own reasons. I love being the big cheese in my own little world and, it all being about my stuff and I get to sing all night. The downside, of course, is if there's any problems, then it's all down to you. But it's been tremendous experience. Like pretty much the last 10 years, I've done most of Eric Clapton stuff, his touring, and that's just been an incredible experience. I mean, obviously the guy is a legend. He's got great artistic integrity. He has world-class musicians of all kinds that I've gotten to know and play with. I think it's helped my own self-esteem somewhat to be accepted and respected by these guys. So, yeah, I mean, when you say it like that, it's quite impressive. I have to remind myself sometimes that I've done these things.
You have you've been making great solo records for a long, long time now. How important was it for you? How much of a difference has it made to have that own company, your own label, and be able to be in control of your fate?
Yeah, I kind of fell into that idea. I mean, I've made an album or, you know, one or two albums for a few record companies in the past and, you know, had good and bad experiences, you know, and there was one experience that wasn't too great where I delivered an album and it was a good album. I'd been working on it. The whole staff had changed and I could tell they weren't really interested in promoting it. And anyway, when I was writing an album called Satisfy My Soul, I didn't want to go shopping it around. I liked it just how it was. And I didn't want people saying, well, yeah, but you just need to do this and just change that. And a good friend of mine, he was the original drummer in Mike and the Mechanics. That's a guy called Pete Van Hook. And he said, well, why don't you just do it yourself? And I had no idea how to, the nuts and bolts of releasing a record. But he helped me tremendously. I mean, it was a very small time. It wasn't a big deal. I just got some a distribution deal. I got some independent pluggers to get some radio play, and that's how it started. And that's 20 years ago. And it turns out that that's a business model now,
right?
You know, that's the way a lot of people are going. So it works out very well for me. I think it's a good move.
You can visit Paul's website at paulcarrick.net. The new album is so good. One-on-one. So I have to ask this. The BBC did a wonderful documentary about you a few years ago, The Man with the Golden Voice. Now, you seem like a very humble guy. Do you ever, you must at times just step back and say, how did I get here from Sheffield?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I don't know how it happened. It was very gradual, mind you. I mean, it wasn't an overnight success.
Right.
We did have a little bit of overnight success with How Long, but then that was quickly followed by a trough. So it's been ups and downs and round in circles, down dead ends, but it's been incredible, actually. And as you say, if I look back retrospectively, it does seem incredible even to me to have got to play with all these great people. But I don't look back that much. I'm busy and I'm trying to do my own stuff and I somewhat succeeded in that, particularly in UK and in Europe. I mean, my one regret is not really establishing myself as a solo touring entity in the States, but you can't have everything.
Well, we're so glad to have new music from you. One-on-One is fantastic. It's a real treat to get to talk with you today. I've enjoyed your music for more years than I can remember.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Cheers.